fell his back, and that he defeated the riders to boot. She chuckled. He will be insufferable.
He didn't actually do it, said Kit.
That will not make a difference to Ragnar, said Tessa gravely.
So?
I'm safe, Kit said. I could go back to the Institute in Los Angeles.
I don't know.
A line of worry had appeared between Tessa's brows.
We felt nervous enough before leaving you, even with you in the Institute and Ragnar nearby to protect you. He even followed you when you went to the Shadow Market.
Did he say why we were going to the Shadow Market? Kit said, forgetting in his sudden fear for Ty not to act suspicious.
Of course not, said Tessa.
He wasn't there to tattle on you, just protect you. She patted his shoulder absently while Kit mused on the strange loyalty of people you barely knew.
The thing is, before, we didn't realize you'd manifest any of the powers of the air. Few of your ancestors have before, save Auraline. We thought if we kept you away from things that might trigger the powers.
No fairies, Kit recalled. No battles.
Exactly. If it happens again, word might spread. Besides, fairies have long memories, and we want to make you as safe as possible.
Does that mean leaving me in the Silent City? Because I don't like it here, Kit said. I'm not good at silent. And I don't want to talk about the bathroom situation.
No, Tessa said.
She took a deep breath, and Kit realized she was actually nervous.
What I'm saying is that you should come and live with me and Jem and the child we're going to have. After all our wandering, we've decided to settle down and build a home. We want you to build it with us, to be part of our family. Kit was almost too stunned to speak, not the least at the revelation that Tessa was pregnant. But why?
Tessa looked at him forthrightly.
Because a long time ago the Herondales gave both Jem and me a home, and we want to do the same for you.
But am I actually a Herondale? He asked. I thought my father was a Herondale and my mother was a Mundane, but it looks like they were both Shadow Hunters, so I don't even know what my name should be.
Your father's real name isn't known, Tessa said. He did have a small amount of Shadow Hunter blood. It allowed him to have the sight.
I thought Shadow Hunter blood bred true.
It does. But over the course of many generations, it can become diluted. Still, your father could have trained and ascended had he wanted. He never did. It was your mother who bore runes. It was your mother who made you the lost Herondale we searched for so long. It is your choice, of course. You can bear any name you wish. We would still welcome you in our family, whether you were called Kit Herondale or not. Kit thought of Jace, and of the mother he had never known, who he remembered now only in the songs she had sung him once, the mother who had given up her own life for his.
I'll be a Herondale, he said. I like the family ring. It's classy.
Tessa smiled at him.
Anyway, Kit said, where are you planning to live?
Jem owns a house in Devon, a big old pile. We'll be going there. We know you care about the Blackthorns, so we'll understand if you want to stay with them, she added quickly. We would be sad, but we would do whatever we can to protect you. Ragnar would help, and Katarina. We'd have to tell the Blackthorns why you needed the protection, of course.
She was still talking, but Kit had stopped hearing her. The words spilled around him in a meaningless rush as all the memories he'd been trying to push back flew at him like sharply pecking birds. The Institute, the beach, the Blackthorns, always kind to him. Emma saving his life. Julian driving him to the market and listening to him talk about Ty. Even then, he'd wanted to talk about Ty. All his energy had gone into Ty, all his devotion and hopes for the future. He liked the other Blackthorns, but he hardly knew them well. He probably knew Drew the best and liked her as a friend, but that was a small thing compared to the burning hurt and humiliation he felt
when he thought about Ty. He didn't blame Ty for what had happened. He blamed himself. He'd been too fixated on not losing Ty to tell him what he needed to hear. Everyone needed to be stopped from making bad choices sometimes, but he hadn't stopped Ty. And he'd gotten what he deserved, really. Now that he knew he meant nothing much to Ty, how could he live in the Institute again? See him every day? Feel like an idiot constantly? Feel the pity of his family? Listen to them tell him he should try to make other friends? Survive in the same house with Ty while Ty avoided him? There was no real question about it. I can't face going back there and living with him. This is my chance to start again and learn what it means to be who I am. I'll go with you. I'd like to live with you, Kit said. Oh, Tessa blinked. Oh! She grabbed his hand and squeezed it, smiling all over her kind face. That's lovely, Kit. That's wonderful. Jem will be so happy, too. And it'll be wonderful for the baby to have company. I mean, hopefully you'll like the baby as well. She blushed. Kit thought it would actually be kind of nice to have a small sibling-type person in his life, but he said nothing. I'm babbling, Tessa said. I'm just so excited. We'll go tonight. Get you safe and settled as fast as possible. We'll arrange for you to have a tutor for all the necessary protection spells to be done by the Silent Brothers. That sounds good, Kit said, a little exhausted already by the thought of everything that needed to be done. I only have this bag, no other luggage. It was true, and there was nothing he cared about much in the bag either, besides the Herondale dagger and the witchlight Ty had given him. I imagine you'd like to say goodbye to the Blackthorns before we go. No, Kit said. I don't want to see them. Tessa blinked. It's better if they don't know all about this first air stuff, Kit said. It's safer for them. Jem can tell them. I just decided L.A. wasn't for me. They're all so far ahead of me in training, and I should learn from the beginning if I want to be a shadow hunter. Tessa nodded. Kit knew she didn't entirely buy this excuse, but she also knew enough not to pry. It was very reassuring. I do have one question before we go, Kit said, and Tessa looked at him curiously. Will I be growing pointy ears? Maybe a tail? I've seen some weird-looking fairies in the shadow market. Tessa grinned. I guess we'll find out. Everyone wanted to come by the canal house and say hello to Emma and Julian, now that they had left the Basilius. People Drew was familiar with, as well as people she wasn't, flooded into the ground floor, bringing flowers and small gifts. New gauntlets for Emma, a gear jacket for Julian. Some were overly bright and cheery and greeted Emma and Julian as if nothing odd had happened to them at all. Some complimented them as if they thought the whole becoming enormous and almost dying was part of a predetermined plan that had paid off nicely. Others were awkward. Those who had been a little too close to the cohort, Drew suspected, as if they wondered if Emma and Julian might grow huge at any moment and squash them right there in the kitchen. One kindly older lady complimented Julian on being tall, and a terrible silence fell. Tavi said, "What's going on?" and Drew had to drag him into the sitting room. A few others seemed to have had major life experiences.
"It just came to me on the field that I should spend more time with my family," said Trini Castell. "Moments of peace are precious moments. We'll never get them back."
"So true," said Julian. He looked as if he were trying not to laugh. Everyone else nodded thoughtfully. It was very strange. For days, Drew had been worried that Emma and Julian would be punished in some way when they woke up, either officially by the Clave or by the ignorant judgment of other shadow hunters, but it didn't seem to be happening. She edged closer to Magnus, who was sitting by the fire, eating the chocolates out of a box someone had brought for Emma. He'd come over with Maris, Max, and Rafe, so they could play with Tavi. Alec, Jace, and Clary were coming later, apparently with some sort of surprise. Isabel and Simon had already returned to the New York Institute to keep an eye on things.
"Why aren't people mad?" she whispered, "at Emma and Julian."
Magnus wiggled his eyebrows at her. Magnus had very amusing eyebrows. Drew had always found him an amusing person generally,
with his immense tallness and refusal to take anything seriously.
Well, Magnus said,
without Julian's war council and his strategy for dealing with Dearborn, it's likely that the cohort would have prevailed. The road the cohort was traveling led to civil war and bloodshed. Everyone is glad it was avoided.
True, said Drusilla. But that was before they became giant angel monsters.
Angels are messengers. Magnus dusted cocoa powder off his hands, looking thoughtful. They speak in strange ways, even to you, their children. Horus and his cohort spoke as if they were doing the angels' will, and because of it people feared them. On the battlefield, burning with heavenly fire, Julian and Emma proved that wasn't the case. The angels spoke through them.
So basically everyone who didn't like Horus wanted a big angel to squash the cohort, Drew said.
Magnus grinned. They don't want to say that, but believe me, it was immensely satisfying to them. At that moment, Jason Clary arrived with Alec and an enormous cake they'd iced themselves. Most of the strangers had already departed, and Ty helped them put it on the sideboard, where the cake box was open to reveal that the lettering said, "Congratulations on not being giants anymore." Everyone laughed and gathered around to cut pieces of lemon chocolate cake. Julian and Emma leaned against each other, their shoulders touching. Since they had returned from the Basileus, it had seemed that a massive weight was off Julian's shoulders. He seemed lighter and happier than he had since before the Dark War. Drew knew that he and Emma were no longer parabatai. The angel magic had burned it out of them somehow. It didn't take a genius to figure out that they were probably very pleased about that, considering all the smiling and hand-touching they were doing. Mark and Christina, on the other hand, seemed sad. They were quiet among all the bright chatter in the room. At one point, Drew saw Emma take Christina into the kitchen and hug her as if something bad had happened. Drew didn't know what it was, but she did notice that Kieran wasn't there. Ty was also quiet. Every time he passed Julian, Jules would pull him in for a hug and ruffle his hair the way he liked when he was little. Ty would smile, but he seemed unusually listless, uninterested in even eavesdropping on the guests' conversations and making notes for his detective manuals the way he usually did. Eventually he went up to Magnus, who was sitting in a deep blue chair by the fireplace, holding his deep blue son on his lap and tickling him. Drew edged closer to the hearth, wondering what Ty wanted to say to the warlock.
"Where's Kit, really?" Ty said. And Drew thought, "I should have known."
Jem had told them that Kit was coming to live with him and Tessa and Devon, but not why, or why they had to leave in such a hurry. Julian and the others seemed to think Kit would visit them soon, but Drew wasn't so sure.
"I keep asking, but no one will tell me."
Magnus looked up, his cat eyes hooded. "Kit's all right. He's with Tessa and Jem. He's going to be living with them."
"I know," Ty said. His voice shook. "I know, but can I say goodbye to him? If I could just talk to him once."
"He's already gone," Magnus said. "He didn't want to say goodbye to you. To anyone, really. But I suspect it was mostly you." Drew had to stifle a gasp. Why would Magnus say something so flatly unkind?
"I don't understand," Ty said, his left hand fluttering at his side. He caught at his wrist with his right hand as if he could stop it.
Julian had always called Ty's hands his butterflies and told him they were beautiful, graceful, and useful. Why not let them fly? But Drew worried. She thought they fluttered like hearts, a sign that Ty was uneasy. Magnus's expression was grave. "Come with me." Magnus gave his son to Maris to carry into the sitting room and headed upstairs, Ty at his heels. Drew didn't hesitate. If Magnus was angry with Ty, she was going to find out why and defend Ty if necessary. Even if Magnus turned her into a toad, she followed. There was an empty bedroom at the top of the stairs. Magnus and Ty went into it, Magnus leaning his long body against the bare wall. Ty sat down on the edge of the bed while Drew stationed herself by the crack in the mostly open door.
"I don't understand," Ty said again.
Drew knew he probably had been working on the problem in his mind all the way up the steps.
What did Magnus mean? Why did Kit not want to say goodbye to him?
"Ty," said Magnus. "I know what you did. Ragnar told me. I wish he'd told me earlier, but then I was dying, so I understand why he didn't."
"Also, he thought he'd headed you off, but he didn't, did he? You got an energy source from the market, you did the spell anyway."
"The spell? The one to raise Livy's ghost?"
Ty stared.
"How do you know?"
"I have sources in the markets," said Magnus. "I'm also a warlock and the son of a greater demon. I can sense the dark magic on you, Ty. It's like a cloud around you I can see." He sat down on the window ledge. "I know you tried to raise your sister from the dead."
"He did what?"
Realization exploded in Drew's mind, along with shock.
"You don't just try to raise the dead. Look at what happened to Malcolm. Trying to communicate with a spirit is one thing. Necromancy, quite another."
Ty didn't protest, though. He sat on the bed, his fingers nodding and unnodding.
"You are so, so lucky your spell didn't work," Magnus said. "What you did was bad. But what you could have done would have been so much worse."
"How could you, Ty? How could you, kid?"
"Clary brought Jace back from the dead," Ty said. "Clary asked Raziel to bring Jace back from the dead. Think about it. Raziel himself. You are messing about in magic reserved for gods, Ty. There are reasons necromancy is something people hate. If you bring back a life, you must pay with something of equal consequence. What if it had been another life? Would you have wanted to kill someone to keep Livy with you?"
Ty lifted his head.
"What if it was Horace? What if it was someone bad? We kill people in battle. I don't see the difference."
Magnus looked at Ty for a long time. Drew was afraid he might say something harsh to him, but the lines of Magnus's face had softened. "Tiberius," he said at last, "when your sister died, she didn't deserve it. Life and death aren't doled out by a judge who decides what is fair. And if it were, would you want to be that judge? Every life at your fingertips, and also every death?" Ty squeezed his eyes shut.
"No,"
he whispered.
"I just want my sister back. I miss her all the time. It feels like there's a hole in me that will never be filled up."
"Oh," Drew thought. How odd that it would be Ty who would most accurately describe what it felt like to lose Livy. She pressed her hand to her side.
"A hole where my sister should be."
"I know," Magnus said gently. "And I know that you've spent a lot of your life knowing you're different, and that's true. You are. So am I." Ty looked up at him. "So you think this feeling you have of missing half of yourself must be fixed? That it couldn't be what everyone else is feeling when they lose someone? But it is. Grief can be so bad you can't breathe. But that's what it means to be human. We lose, we suffer, but we have to keep breathing."
"Are you going to tell everyone?" Ty said in a near whisper.
"No," Magnus said. "Provided you promise never to do anything like that again." Ty looked nauseated.
"I never would."
"I believe it. But Ty, there's something else I'd like you to do. I can't order you to do it. I can only suggest it." Ty had picked up a pillow. He was running his hand over the rough, textured side of it over and over, his palm reading messages in the fabric.
"I know you always wanted to go to the Skullomance," said Magnus. Ty started to protest. Magnus held up a hand.
"Just let me finish, and then you can say anything you want to," Magnus said. "At the LA Institute, Helen and Aline can keep you safe and love you. I know you might not want to leave your family.
But what you need is mysteries to solve, to keep your mind busy and your soul filled. I've known people like you before. They don't rest until their minds are flying free and solving problems. I knew Conan Doyle back in the day. He loved to travel. Spent his third year of medical school on a whaling boat. Ty stared. Magnus seemed to realize he'd veered off course. All I'm saying is that you have a curious mind, he said. You want to solve mysteries, to be a detective of life. That's why you always wanted to go to the Scholomance. But you didn't think you could, because your twin wanted to be Parabatai with you, and you couldn't do both. I would have given up the Scholomance for her, Ty said. Besides, everyone I met who went there, Zara and the others, was awful. The Scholomance is going to be quite different now, said Magnus. The cohort poisoned it, but they'll be gone. I think it would be a wonderful place for you. His voice gentled. Grief is hard. Change can be all that helps. Thanks, Ty said. Can I think about it? Of course. Magnus looked weary and a little regretful, as if he wished things could have been different, as if he wished there was something else to say than the things he'd said. He turned toward the door, Drew shrank back, and paused. You understand that from now on you're tied to the ghost of your sister, Magnus said. Tied to the ghost of your sister? Livy's ghost? I do understand, Ty said. Magnus stared at the door of the bedroom, as if he were seeing through into the past. You think you do, he said. But you don't really see it. I know she set you free in the forest. Right now this feels better than nothing, better than being without her. You don't yet understand the price, and I hope you never have to pay it. He touched Ty's shoulder lightly, without looking at him, and left. Drew ducked into the next bedroom until Magnus's footsteps had disappeared down the stairs. Then she took a deep breath and went in to talk to Ty. He hadn't moved from the end of the bed in the empty room. He stared into the gathering shadows, his face pale, as he looked up at her. Drew, he said haltingly. You should have told me, Drew said. He furrowed his arched eyebrows. You were listening? She nodded. I know, he said. I didn't want you to stop me, and I'm not good at lying. It's easier for me to just not say. Kit lied to me, she said. She was furious at Kit, though she tried not to show it. Maybe it was better he wasn't coming back with them, even if he'd shown her how to pick locks. Livy's ghost, is she really around? I saw her today. She was in the Basilius when Emma and Julian woke up. She was sitting on one of the bureaus. I never know when she's going to be there or not be there. Magnus said she's tied to me, so maybe you can teach me to see her. Drew knelt down and put her arms around Ty. She could feel the slight vibrations going through his body. He was shaking. Maybe we can see her together. We can't tell anyone, Ty said, but he had his arms around Drew, too. He was hugging her, his hair against her cheek as soft and fine as Tavi's. No one can know. I won't say anything. She held on to her brother, held on hard, as if she could keep him tethered to the earth. I'll never tell.
Emma lay atop the covers of her bed, the only light in the room, the reflected radiance of the demon towers as it shone through the window. She supposed it wasn't surprising that she couldn't sleep. She'd slept for 3 days and awakened to a series of shocks, realizing what had happened. Jem's explanation, the house full of people. The odd feeling that followed her constantly when she'd forgotten something, that she'd put something down in the other room and needed to remember to get it. It was the Parabatai bond, she knew. Her body and her brain hadn't caught up to the fact that it was gone. She was missing it the way people who lost limbs sometimes still felt them there. She was missing Julian. They'd been together all day, but always surrounded by other people. When the house had finally emptied of strangers, Julian had taken Tavi up to bed, bidding her an awkward good night in front of the others. She'd gone up to bed herself not long after, and had been lying there, worrying, for hours. Would everything be awkward now that they weren't Parabatai? Now that they floated in a new, foreign place between being friends and lovers? They had never declared themselves because words like boyfriend and girlfriend seemed banal in the face of curses and giant monsters. What if everything that had happened was so devastating that they could never reach a place of normalcy? She couldn't stand it. She rolled out of bed, got onto her feet, and smoothed down her nightgown. She flung open her bedroom door, ready to march across the hall to Julian's room and make him talk to her, no matter how awkward it might be. Just outside her door stood Julian, his hand outstretched, looking as surprised to see her as she was to see him. He lowered his hand slowly, the distant moonlight glinting off his sea glass bracelet. The hallway was dark and quiet, casting Julian's face into shadow. "I didn't know if you'd want me to come in," he said. Relief made Emma sag against the doorway. "I do want you to come in." She moved back into the room while he shut the door behind him. They were both in darkness now, only the light of the glass towers providing illumination. Julian, in all black, was a shadow among shadows as he looked down at her. His hair looked black, too, striking against his pale skin. "I didn't know if you'd want me to kiss you." She didn't move. More than anything else, she wanted him to come to her and put his hands on her. She wanted to feel him against her when the space between them was no longer a space of cursed and forbidden things. "I do want you to kiss me," she whispered. He closed the distance between them in one step. His hands cupped the back of her head, his mouth slanting down over hers, hot and sweet as tea with honey. She ran her teeth lightly across his bottom lip, and he made a guttural sound that raised the hairs along her arms. His warm lips moved to graze her cheek, her jawbone. "I didn't know if you'd want me to touch you," he murmured against her skin. It was a pleasure just to look up at him slowly, to know that none of this needed to be rushed. She slipped her nightgown over her head and watched his face go tight with desire, his eyes dark as the bottom of the sea. "I want you to touch me," she said. "There's nothing you can do to me that I wouldn't want, because it's you." He caught her in his arms, and it was strange for a moment, her bare skin against his clothes, cotton and denim and metal rivets as he lifted her up and carried her to bed. They crashed into it together. Julian struggled out of his shirt, his jeans. Emma crawled atop him, leaning down to kiss his throat, to lick and suck at the pulse point there where she could feel the beating of his heart. "I want to go slowly," she whispered. "I want to feel everything." He gripped her hips and flipped their position, rolling over so that he was above her. He grinned down at her wickedly. "Slowly it is," he said. He started with her fingers, kissing each one. He kissed the palms of her hands and her wrists, her shoulders and her collarbones. He traced a path of kisses over her stomach until she was writhing and gasping and threatening him, which only made him laugh softly and turn his attention to even more sensitive places. When the world had gone white behind her eyes several times, he rose up over her and brushed her damp hair away from her face. "Now," he whispered, and covered her mouth with his own as they joined their bodies together. It was slow, as he had said it would be, as it had never been before. There was no desperation beyond their desire. They lay crosswise on the bed, sprawled and hungry, yearning and touching. She stroked his face lightly, reverently, the curve of his mouth, his eyelashes fluttering against his cheekbones. And with every touch and moment, his breath grew more ragged, his grip on the sheets tighter. Her back arched to meet him, her head full of sparks. They rose and blended together until everything was fire. And when they caught a light at last, neither able to wait a moment longer,
They were one person. They were incandescent as angels. From Mark's room, he could see the moon, and it troubled him. There had been so many nights on horseback, the moon riding with him, as if it, too, hunted the sky. He could hear Kieran's laughter in his ears, even now, clear laughter, untouched by sorrow. He hoped Kieran would laugh again like that someday. He could only picture him sitting in darkness, in the blackened throne room of the king, a bleak and lonely place. A king of shattered hearts and broken souls, solitary on his granite throne, growing older slowly through the ages of the world. It was more than he could stand. He was grateful beyond measure when Christina slipped into his room and crawled into the bed with him. She wore white pajamas, her hair loose and dark. She curled up against his side, pressing her face into his neck. Her cheeks were wet with tears. "Is this really how it ends? The three of us, all miserable?" he said. She placed her hand over his heart. "I love you, Mark," she said, her voice gentle. "I hate to think of your heart torn as mine is." "I am happier when you are here," he said, placing his hand over hers. And yet, she said. "I have an idea, Mark. Perhaps a mad one. But it might work. It might mean we could see him again." Her dark eyes were straightforward. "I would need your help." He drew her up his body and kissed her. She went soft against him, her body curving into his. She was rich and sweet as honey, silken as a bed of wildflowers. She was the only woman he would ever love. He thumbed the tears away from her cheeks and whispered, "My hand, my heart, my blade are yours. Tell me what I need to do." Emma lay with her head on Julian's chest, feeling the beat of her heart slowly return to normal. Somehow most of the covers had come off the bed and were on the floor. They were half-wrapped in sheets, Julian's free hand idly playing with her hair. "So I guess you feel pretty good about yourself," she said. He blinked at her sleepily. "Why would that be?" She laughed, her breath stirring the dark curls of his hair. "If you don't know, I'm not going to tell you," he smiled. "How do you feel?" She folded her arms on his chest, looking up at him. "Happy. So happy, but also like I don't deserve to be." His hand stilled in her hair. "Why not? You deserve to be happy more than anyone I know." "If it wasn't for you, I would have done a terrible thing," Emma said. "I would have broken all the parabatide bonds. It would have caused so much devastation." "You were half crazy from the curse," Julian said. "You weren't thinking straight." "Still, I let myself be manipulated by the queen, even though I knew she only cares about herself. I knew it, and I let her get into my head. I should have had faith."
"But you did," he said. "Faith isn't never having any doubts. It's about having what you need to overcome them." He lightly stroked her cheek. "We all have things we regret doing. I regret asking Magnus to do that spell. I regret that we couldn't help Ash. He was just a kid."
"I know," she said. "I hate that we left him behind. But if he was here, someone would always be looking for him. All it would take is some spells from the Black Volume to make him so powerful, everyone would want to use him."
"Good thing there aren't any Black Volumes left," said Julian. "For a while it was like a whack-a-mole game. I guess I contributed to that," he smiled crookedly.
"Oh, and I regret killing Dane Larkspear."
"He was going to kill us," Emma said. "You did what you had to do."
"Ah, there's the murderous girl I know and love," said Julian. "I don't know how I'll ever make up for Dane. But I have faith he'll help me figure it out."
"I believe you deserve to be happy," Emma said. "You're the bravest and most loving person I know."
"And I believe you deserve to be happy," said Julian.
So how about I believe it for you and you believe it for me? We can believe it for each other. Emma glanced toward the window. She could see the first traces of sunlight in the sky. Morning was breaking. She looked up at Julian. Dawn touched the edges of his hair and eyelashes with gold.
Do you have to go back to your room? She whispered.
He smiled down at her. No, he said. We don't have to lie or pretend now. We don't have to lie or pretend ever again. It was the first time Emma had been in the council hall since Livy had died. It wasn't the only reason she was desperate for the meeting to be over, but it was certainly part of it. The blood might have been scrubbed out of the dais, but she would always see it there. She knew it was the same for Julian. He tensed beside her as they went in through the doors with the rest of the Blackthorns. The whole family was quiet, even Tabby. The hall was filled to bursting. Emma had never seen it so full. Shadow hunters were smashed together on the rows of seats, and the aisles were filled with those who were standing. Some were projecting in from distant institutes, their half-transparent shimmering forms glowing along the back wall. Emma recognized Isabel and Simon among them and waved. Thankfully, seats had been kept for the Blackthorns by Jaime and Diego. Jaime had held an entire row by lying across it. He popped up when they approached and let them all slide in, winking at several glaring shadow hunters who had been hoping to find a seat. People stared at all the Blackthorns, but especially Emma and Julian as they took their seats. It had been the same at the house the day before, strangers gawking wide-eyed. Emma remembered what she had thought about Jason Clary at the War Council meeting. So this is what it's like to be heroes, to be the ones with angel blood, the ones who've literally saved the world. People look at you as if, almost as if you're not real. As it turned out, it made you wonder yourself how real you were. Emma wound up sitting beside Christina and Julian, her fingertips touching Julian's discreetly on the seat between them. Now that she and Julian were no longer parabatai, all she wanted was to get home and start their new life. They would discuss their travel year and plan all the places they would go. They would visit Christina in Mexico and Jason Clary in New York and Great Aunt Marjorie in England. They would go to Paris and stand in front of the Eiffel Tower holding hands, and there would be nothing wrong with it and nothing forbidden. Maybe it would be a short meeting? She glanced around the room, noting the serious expressions on everyone's faces, knots of those who had been friendly to the cohort but who had not fought with him on the field, huddled together on benches, whispering. Dearborn sympathizers like Laszlo Balog, who had remained in the city for the duration of the battle, hadn't been arrested. Only those who had raised weapons against other Nephilim would stand trial. "People look grim," she muttered to Julian. "No one wants to sentence the cohort," he said. "A lot of them are young. It feels brutal, I think."
"Zar deserves sentencing," Emma muttered. "She stabbed me, and she totally upset Christina with that whole fake engagement."
Julian looked over at Christina, who had her head on Mark's shoulder. "I think Christina has moved on," he said. "And Diego, too." Emma darted a look to where Diego, his cheek bandaged, was sitting and chatting with a glowing Divya, who had been thrilled Anoush had fought on their side on the field. "Interesting." There was a rustle and a flourish as the guards closed the side doors and Gia entered through the back of the hall. The room hushed as she moved down to the dais, her robes sweeping the steps. Behind her, wearing the flame-colored tunics of prisoners, were the captured cohort members. There were perhaps 50 or 60 of them, many of them young, just as Julian had said. So many had been recruited through the Scholomance and its outreach. Vanessa Ashdown, Manuel Villalobos, Amelia Overbeck, and Zara herself, her expression defiant. They filed onto the dais behind Gia, the guards guiding them into rows. Some were still bandaged from the battle. All wore Eratzis. Their tunics were printed with runes meant to keep them trapped in the city. They could not pass the gates of Alicante.
flame to wash away our sins, Emma thought. It was odd to see prisoners with their hands unbound. But even if each of them had been freely bearing two long swords, they would hardly have been a match for the hundreds of other shadow hunters in the council hall. She saw Diego lean over to whisper something to Jaime, who shook his head, his face troubled.
"We come together in a time of grief and healing," announced Gia, her voice echoing off the walls. "Thanks to the bravery of so many shadow hunters, we have fought nobly. We have found new allies. We have preserved our relationships with downworlders, and we have opened a new way forward."
Zara made a horrible face at the phrase, "preserved our relationships." Emma hoped she would be sentenced to cleaning toilets for the rest of eternity.
"However," said Gia, "I am not the leader who can take us on that path."
Murmurs ran through the room. Was Gia really saying what they thought she was saying? Emma bolted upright in her seat and looked over at Aline, but she seemed as shocked as the rest of the room. Patrick Penhollow, though, seated in the front row, seemed unsurprised.
"I will preside over the sentencing of the cohort," Gia continued, unfazed. "But it will be my last act as consul. After that, there will be an open election for a new consul and a new inquisitor."
Helen whispered to Aline, who took her hand. Emma felt a chill go through her. This was a surprise, and the last thing she wanted was a surprise. She knew it was selfish. She remembered Jem saying that Gia was ill, but still, Gia was a known quantity. The unknown loomed.
"And when I say an open election," Gia continued, "I mean an open election. Everyone in this hall will have a vote. Everyone will have a voice. No matter their age, no matter if they're projecting from their home institute, no matter," she added, "if they are members of the cohort."
A roar went through the room.
"But they are criminals,"
shouted Joaquin Acosta Romero, head of the Buenos Aires Institute.
"Criminals do not have a vote."
Gia waited patiently for the roar to die down into quiet. Even the cohort were staring at her in puzzlement.
"Look how full this council hall is," she said.
People twisted around in their seats to stare at the overflowing rows of seats, the hundreds of projections in the back of the room.
"You're all here because over the past week, and especially since the battle, you have realized how urgent the situation always was. The Clave was nearly taken over by extremists, who would have driven us into isolation and self-destruction. And everyone who stood back and allowed this to happen, through inattention, through apathy, and overconfidence," her voice shook, "well, we are all guilty. And therefore, we will all vote, as a reminder that every voice counts. And when you choose not to use your voice, you are letting yourself be silenced."
"But I still don't see why the criminals should vote,"
yelled Jaime, who had apparently taken the "no matter their age" portion of the speech to heart.
"Because if they don't," said Diana, rising to her feet and addressing the room, "they will always be able to say that whoever the new consul is, they were elected because the majority had no voice. The cohort has always flourished by telling the lie that they speak for all shadow hunters, that they say the words that everyone would speak if they could. Now we will test that lie. All shadow hunters will speak, including them."
Gia assented gravely.
"Miss Rayburn is correct." "So what will be done with the prisoners then?" called Kadir. "Will they walk among us? Free?"
"The cohort must be punished! They must be!"
The voice was a raw scream. Emma turned and flinched. She felt Julian's hand tighten on hers. It was Elena Larkspear. She was alone. Her husband had not come to the meeting. She looked as haggard as if she'd aged 50 years in the past week.
"They used our children, as if they were trash, to do the things too filthy or dangerous for them to do. They murdered my daughter and my son. I demand reparations."
She fell back into her seat with a dry sob. covering her face with her hands. Emma stared at the cohort, her throat aching. Even Zara was having a hard time wiping the look of horror off her face. "They will not go unpunished," said Gia gently. "They have been tested by the mortal sword and confessed to their crimes. They sent Dane Larkspear to murder other shadow hunters, and were thus directly responsible for his death." She inclined her head toward Elena. "They murdered Oscar Lindquist, that a demon might take his place at a meeting held at the Los Angeles Institute. Led by Horace Dearborn, this group used lies and intimidation to try to lead the Clave into a false alliance with Fairy.
And now you people are trying to lead the Clave into an alliance with the new king. How is that different?"
Zara shouted, rallying. Emma whipped her head around to study the room. Many shadow hunters looked angry or annoyed, but there were those who clearly didn't disagree with Zara.
"Ugh."
A voice rang out clearly, stony and cold. Alec Lightwood's. "Because open political engagement is very different from disavowing any relationship to downworlders in public while conspiring to commit murder with them behind the backs of the people you're meant to be governing. The cohort imprisoned loyal Nephilim and sent others to their deaths," said Gia after a withering glance at Zara. "We were brought to the brink of civil war." She looked out at the Clave. "You might think we want to punish them severely, to strip their marks and send them into the mundane world they so despise. But we must consider mercy. So many of the cohort are young, and they were influenced by misinformation and outright lies. Here we can give them a chance to again rejoin the Clave and redeem themselves, to turn from the path of deceit and hate and walk once again in the light of Razio." More murmurs. The members of the cohort looked at each other in confusion. Some seemed relieved, some angrier than ever. "After this meeting," Gia went on, "the cohort will be split up and sent to different institutes. Several of the institutes who attended Julian Blackthorne's war council have offered to take in former cohort members and show them a better way. They will have a chance to prove themselves before they return to the homeland." Now there was an eruption of chatter. Some shouted the punishment was lenient. Some shouted that it was cruel to exile them from Alicante. Gia stilled the shouting with a gesture. "Any who are not in favor of this punishment, please raise your hand or voice. Manuel Villalobos, you are not allowed to vote on this issue." Zara pinned Manuel, whose hand was half raised, with a scowl. A few more hands were raised. Emma almost wanted to raise hers and to say that they deserved worse. But then she had spared Zara's life on the field, and the gesture had led to all of this, had led to the end of the battle, and her and Julian's freedom. Maybe Arthur had been right. Maybe mercy was better than revenge. She kept her hand down, as did all the other Blackthorns. No one she knew well raised their hand, not even Diego or Jaime, who had good cause to hate Zara and her friends. Gia looked relieved. "And now," she said, "to the election of the new consul." Jace was on his feet before she finished speaking. "I nominate Alec Lightwood." The Blackthorns clapped fiercely. Alec looked stunned and touched. Clary cheered, and the cheer spread. Many in the room waved their hands in support, and Emma's heart swelled. Jace could have reached out for the position of consul had he wanted. He and Clary were beloved. Either would win handily. But he had put Alec forward for it, because it was what Alec wanted, and because Jace knew Alec was the right choice. Delaney Scarsberry rose to his feet, his face red.
"I object. Alec Lightwood is much too young. He lacks experience and notoriously consorts with downworlders."
"You mean by heading up the Downworlder Shadow Hunter Alliance where his job is to consort with downworlders?" called Julian.
"He does it in his free time as well, Blackthorn," said Scarsberry with a nasty smile. Emma rather wished Magnus was there and could turn him into a toad, but downworlders weren't at the meeting.
They had refused to be in the same room as the cohort members, and Emma couldn't blame them.
"You know what they mean," called Zara. "He's a filthy pervert. Jace should stand for consul instead."
"I'm also a filthy pervert," said Jace. "Or at least I aspire to be. You have no idea what I get up to in my spare time. Just last week I asked Clary to buy me a..."
Clary pulled him down next to her and belabored him with her fists. He grinned.
"What about Patrick Penhallow?" someone shouted. "He knows what he's doing."
Patrick, seated in the front row, rose to his feet with a stony expression.
"I will not stand as consul," he said. "My wife has given enough. My daughter has given enough. It is time for my family to be allowed some peace and rest."
He sat down in dead silence. Delaney Scarsbury said,
"I nominate Laszlo Balog."
Real fear stabbed through Emma for the first time that day. She and Julian looked at each other, both remembering the same moment. Laszlo rising in the Hall of Accords to deliver the words that sent Helen into exile and abandoned Mark to the hunt.
"Both Mark and Helen Blackthorne have the blood of fairies in them. We know the boy's already joined up with the Wild Hunt, so he's beyond us. But the girl shouldn't be among shadow hunters. It isn't decent."
Those who hadn't cheered for Alec's nomination looked pleased, as did the cohort.
"He'd be an awful consul," Emma said to Julian. "He'd set everything back."
"We don't really have a better system," said Julian. "All we can do is ask people what they want."
"And hope they choose the right thing," said Christina.
"Alec would look much better on the money," said Mark. "We don't put the consul on the money," said Julian. "And we don't print money, anyway."
"We could start doing both," said Mark.
"Alec Lightwood has never even lived in Idris," said Laszlo, rising up. "What does he know about governing our homeland?"
Alec rose to his feet.
"My parents were exiled," he said. "And most shadow hunters don't live in Idris. How will you govern them if you think the only shadow hunters that matter live in Alicante?"
"Your parents were exiled because they were in the circle," snapped Balog.
"And he has learned from his parents' mistakes,"
Maris snapped.
"My son knows better than anyone else the horror that bigotry and prejudice can bring."
Alec gave her a nod and spoke coolly.
"You voted for my father for Inquisitor, Balog, so it didn't bother you then," he said.
"My father gave his life in this room for the Clave. What have you done besides exile Shadowhunter children because you were afraid of their fairy blood?"
"Damn," said someone in the back, "he's good."
"Lightwood would end the Downworlder Registry," said Laszlo, "and the Cold Peace."
"You're right, I would," said Alec. "I can't live in fear of Downworlders. Downworlders gave us portals. They gave us a victory over Valentine. They gave us a victory on the fields just now. We cannot keep pretending we don't need them, any more than they can pretend they don't need us. Our future depends on our mandate. We are the hunters of demons, not the hunters of our own allies. If prejudice sidetracks us, we may all die."
Laszlo's expression darkened. Applause ran through the room, though not all were applauding. Many shadow hunters sat with their hands clasped firmly in their laps.
"I think it has come time for a vote,"
said Gia. She took a tarnished glass vessel from a stand on the dais and handed it down to Patrick in the front row. He bent his head and whispered into the vial. Emma watched with interest. She had heard of the process of voting for consul, but had never seen it. The vial went from hand to hand, each shadow hunter whispering into it as if confessing a secret. Those projecting had the vial held out to them by obliging hands, since projections could speak but not touch objects. When the vial came to her, she lifted it to her mouth and said,
"Alexander Lightwood,"
in a firm, loud voice. She heard Julian chuckle as she passed it along to Christina. At last, the vial had been shared with every shadow hunter save the cohort. It was given to Gia, who passed it along to Zara.
"Vote wisely," she said. "The freedom to choose your own consul is a great responsibility.
For a moment, Zara looked as if she might spit in the jar. She jerked it out of Gia's hand, spoke into it, and handed it to Manuel on her right. He smirked as he whispered into the jar, and Emma's shoulders tightened, knowing that every cohort vote was a vote against Alec. At last, the final vote was cast, and the jar returned to Gia, who took out her steely and drew a rune on its side. The vial shook in her hand as pale smoke poured from its open neck, the expelled breath of hundreds of Nephilim. It formed into words across the air.
Alexander Gideon Lightwood.
Clary and Jace flung themselves at Alec, laughing as the air exploded with cheers. Aline and Helen gave Alec a mutual thumbs up. The projections of Isabel and Simon waved from the back of the room. The Blackthorns whooped and applauded. Emma whistled. Maris Lightwood wiped away tears of happiness as Kadir patted her shoulder gently. "Alec Lightwood," cried Gia. "Please rise. You are the new consul of the Clave."
Emma had expected an outburst from Laszlo, or at least a look of black rage. Instead, he merely smirked coldly as Alec rose to his feet among cheers and applause.
"This vote doesn't count. It shouldn't count," shouted Zara. "If those who died on the field could have voted, Alec Lightwood would never have won."
"I will work toward your rehabilitation, Zara," said Alec evenly.
Silver flashed.
Zara had snatched a long dagger from the weapons belt of a guard standing near her. He made no move to stop her. There were gasps as the rest of the guards tossed weapons to the other cohort members, steel sparking in the light from the great windows.
"We refuse to recognize Alec Lightwood as consul," shouted Manuel. "We stand for our old traditions, for the way things always have been and always should be."
"Guards!"
Gia shouted, but the 20 or so guards were making no effort to stop the cohort. In fact, they had joined them in a flurry of unsheathed daggers. Emma glanced at Laszlo Balog, who was watching with folded arms, clearly unsurprised. Somehow, Emma realized, the cohort's allies had planted guards who were sympathetic to their cause. But what on earth were they planning? There was still only a fraction of them compared to the overwhelming number of Shadow Hunters who had voted for Alec.
Gia leapt down from the dais, unsheathing her Tao. All over the hall, Shadow Hunters were rising to their feet and drawing arms. Alec had reached for his bow, Jace his sword. Drew reached for Tavi, her face pale, as the rest of the family took out their weapons. Then Zara raised her dagger and put it to her own throat.
Movement in the room ceased. Emma still gripped Cortana, staring as Manuel followed Zara's gesture, placing the blade of his own dagger against his throat. Amelia Overbeck did the same. Vanessa Ashdown followed, and Milo Coldridge, until all the cohort members stood with blades to their throats.
"You can put your weapons down,"
said Zara, holding the knife against her throat so tightly that blood dripped down her hand.
"We are not here to harm our fellow Shadow Hunters. You have harmed yourselves enough with your foolish and short-sighted vote. We are acting to save Alicante from corruption and the glass towers from ruin."
Her eyes glittered madly.
"You spoke before of the value of the lands outside Alicante, as if Alicante were not the heart of our people. Very well, then. Go out and embrace the mundane world, away from the angel's light."
"Are you demanding we leave Alicante?" said Diana in disbelief.
"We who are Nephilim as you are?" "No consort of a fairy is as Nephilim as I am," Zara spat. "Yes, we ask, we demand, that you go. Clary Fairchild can create portals. Let her make one now. Step through it and go where you wish. Anywhere that is not Alicante."
"You are only a few people," said Emma.
"You can't kick the rest of us out of Alicante. It's not your treehouse."
"I am sorry it came to this," said Laszlo, "but we are not a few people. We are many more. You may have intimidated people into voting for Lightwood, but their hearts are with us."
"You would propose a civil war here in the council hall?" demanded Diana.
"Not a civil war," said Zara.
"We know we cannot win against you in a battle. You have too many filthy tricks. You have warlocks on your side. She glared at Alec. But we are willing to die for our beliefs and for Alicante. We will not leave. We will spill Shadowhunter blood. Yes, our own blood. We will cut our own throats and die here at your feet. Either you will go, or we will wash this room clean in our blood. Jaime rose to his feet. Call their bluff, he said. They cannot hold us hostage.
Zara nodded to Amelia, who plunged the dagger she held into her stomach and twisted it viciously to the side. She fell to her knees, spurting blood, as the room exploded with gasps of horror.
Can you build your new clave on the blood of dead children?
Zara screamed at Alec.
You said you would show mercy. If you let us die, every time you step in this room, from this moment onward, you will be walking on our corpses.
Everyone looked at Gia, but Gia was looking at Alec. Alec, the new consul. He was studying not Zara's face, but the faces of the others in the room. Those who looked at Zara as if she were the promise of freedom. There was no mercy on the faces of the cohort. Not a one of them reached for Amelia as her blood ran out across the floor. Very well, said Alec with a deadly calm. We will go. Zara's eyes widened. Emma suspected she had not expected her plan to work, but had hoped to die as a martyr and destroy Alec and the rest of them in the process.
You understand, Laszlo said, that once you go, Lightwood, you cannot return. We will lock the wards of Idris against you, tear the portal from the walls of the guard, brick up the entrances from the Silent City. You will never be able to come back.
Brick up the entrances to the Silent City? Said Diego. You would cut off your own access to the Silent Brothers? To the cup and sword?
Who holds Idris holds the mortal mirror, said Laszlo. As for the Silent Brothers, they have been corrupted, as the Iron Sisters have. We will cut them off from Alicante, until they see the error of their ways, until they see who the true Shadow Hunters are.
The world is bigger than Idris, said Jace, standing tall and proud beside Alec. You think you are taking our homeland, but you are making it your prison. Just as we can never return, you will never be able to leave.
Outside the wards of Idris, we will fight on to protect the world, Alec said. In here, you will rot, as you play at being soldiers, with nothing to fight but each other.
Alec turned his back on Balog, moving to face the clave.
Let's open the portal now, he said. Those who do not live in Alicante return through it to your homes. Those who live here will have a choice. Gather your families and come with us, or remain here, trapped forever with the cohort as your rulers. It is the choice of each Shadow Hunter, whether they wish to be imprisoned or free.
Clary rose to her feet and walked to the doors at the back of the room, taking her steely from her pocket. The clave watched in silence as her steely flashed in her hand, and a silvery gray whirlwind began to grow against the doors, opening outward, shimmering along the walls until it had become an enormous portal. She turned to look at the room.
I'll keep this open for as long as anyone needs to leave, Idris, she said, her voice firm and clear. I'll be the last who passes through. Who wants to be the first?
Emma stood, and Julian moved with her, acting together as they always had.
We will follow our consul, Emma said.
The Blackthorns will go first, Julian said. Keep your prison, Zara. We will be free without you.
The rest of their family rose with them. Aline went to Gia and looped her arm around her mother's. Emma would have thought the room would have been full of cries and chaos, of arguing and fighting. But it seemed as if a cloak of stunned acceptance had been drawn over the Shadowhunters, both those leaving and those staying. The cohort and their allies watched in silence as the majority of Shadowhunters either headed toward the portal, or went to gather up their things from their Alicante homes. Alicante would be a ghost town, a ghost city in a ghost land, Emma thought. She looked for Diana, found her in a nearby crowd.
Your father's shop, she said. Your apartment.
Diana just smiled. I don't mind, she said. I was always coming back with you to Los Angeles, love. I'm a teacher, not a shop owner in Idris. And why would I want to live somewhere Gwen couldn't go? Christina hugged Diego and Jaime as they stood, ready to return to Mexico City. Divya and Rayan were preparing themselves. So were Cameron and Paige Ashdown, though Vanessa still stood on the dais, glaring at them with narrowed eyes. Amelia's body lay at her feet. Emma felt a twist of pity. To sacrifice so much for a cause that cared nothing for you, and then to die unmourned, it seemed too cruel. Cameron turned his back on Vanessa, heading for the stairs, joining the Blackthorns and their friends as Clary directed the portal to return them to Los Angeles. He didn't look back at his cousin. Emma hoped he saw her smile at him, encouragingly. The Ashdowns weren't the only family that would be torn apart by this. But with every step she took toward the portal, she knew she was doing the right thing. No shining new world could be built on blood and bones. The portal rose up before Emma, lucent and shimmering. Through it she could see the ocean and the shore, the looming shape of the Institute. Finally, the Blackthorns were going home. They had passed through blood, through disaster, and now through exile. But they were going home at last. She took Julian's hand, and they stepped through. Chapter 34 The City in the Sea. Kieran had been waiting in the meadow for some time now. No one ever told you, he thought, that when you became a king of a fairy court, you would have to wear very itchy velvet and silk nearly all the time. The boots were nice. The king had his own cobbler, who molded the leather to his feet. But he could have done without wearing a jeweled belt, heavy rings, and a doublet with 5 pounds of embroidery on it on a bright summer day. A rustle in the grass announced the arrival of General Winter, who bowed deeply before Kieran. Kieran had told him many times not to do that, but Winter persisted.
Adayan Kingson, your brother, he announced and stepped aside, allowing Adayan to pass him and come close to Kieran.
The two brothers regarded each other. Adayan wore the green livery of a page of the Seelie Court. It suited him. He seemed rested and calm, his dark eyes thoughtful as he gazed at Kieran.
You sought private word with me, my liege, he said.
Winter, turn your back, Kieran said.
In truth, he did not mind what Winter heard. He had not bothered keeping secrets from the head of his guards. It was better for a king not to have secrets if he could avoid it, in his opinion. It simply gave the tools for blackmail into enemy hands. Winter walked a few steps away and turned his back. There was a rustle as the handful of redcaps who had come with him did the same. Adayan raised an eyebrow, but surely he could not be surprised. The guards were good at making themselves invisible, but kings did not stand around in meadows alone and unprotected.
You have come all the way to the doors of an enemy court to see me, said Adayan. I suppose I am complimented.
You are the only brother I've ever trusted, Kieran said, and I came to ask you if you wished, if you would consider becoming king in my place.
Adayan's eyebrows flickered like bird wings.
Do you not enjoy being king?
It is not to be enjoyed or not enjoyed. It does not matter. I have left Mark and Christina, who I love, to stand as king. But I cannot bear it. I cannot live like this.
Kieran fiddled with his heavy rings.
I cannot live without them.
And they would not survive the court.
Adayan fingered his chin thoughtfully.
Kieran, I am not going to become king for two reasons. One is that with you on the king's throne and me beside the queen, we can work toward a peace between Seelie and Unseelie. The queen hated Oran, but she does not hate you.
Adayan, Kieran's voice was raw.
No, Adayan said firmly. Already I have made the queen see the wisdom of a peace between the lands. But if I leave her to become the king of Unseelie, she will hate me, and we will
return to being enemies. Kieran took a deep breath. The meadow smelled of wildflowers, but he felt nauseated, sick and hot and despairing. How could he live without hearing Christina's voice again, without seeing Mark's face?
What was your second reason, then?
You've been a good king, Adain said. Though you have only held the position these past weeks, Kieran, you've already done many fine things. Released prisoners, enacted a fair redistribution of land, changed the laws for the better. Our people are loyal to you. So if I had been an incompetent king like Obon, I might have had the life I want, Kieran said bitterly. A strange reward for work well done. I am sorry, Kieran, Adain said, and Kieran knew it must be true. But there is no one else. At first, Kieran could not speak. Before him, he saw the long days stretching away without love in them or trust. He thought of Mark laughing, wheeling Windspear around, his strong body and golden hair. He thought of Christina dancing, smoke and flame in the night, her softness and her boundless generosity of spirit. He would not find those things again. He would not find such hearts again.
I understand, Kieran said remotely. This was the end, then.
He would have a life of dutiful service, a life that would stretch on many years, and only the pleasure of doing good, which was not nothing, to sustain him. If only the Wild Hunt had known this would be the fate of their wildest hunter, they would have laughed.
I must uphold my duty. I regret that I asked.
Adain's face softened.
I do not hold duty above love, Kieran.
I must tell you, I heard from Christina.
Kieran's head jerked up. What?
She made a suggestion that I give you my cottage. It exists in a place on the borderlands that is neither fairy nor the mortal world. It would neither weaken you as the mortal world would, nor would Mark and Christina be under threat as they would be in the court.
Adain laid his hand on Kieran's silk and velvet shoulder.
You could be with them there.
The raw emotion he felt nearly rocked Kieran off his feet.
You would do that, Adain. You would give me your cottage.
Adain smiled.
Of course. What are brothers for? Emma was sitting on her suitcase in the hopes of trying to get it to close. She thought regretfully of all the stuff she'd already snuck into Julian's bag. He was an organized and minimalist packer, and had had a zipped suitcase ready to go in the hallway for a week now. It was starting to look a little bulgy with the extra items she'd snuck in while he wasn't looking. A hairbrush, a bag of ponytail holders, flip-flops, and a few extra sunglasses. And a neck pillow. You never knew when you were going to need a neck pillow. Especially when you were taking your entire travel year to wander the globe.
Are you ready to go to the party?
It was Christina in an airy blue dress, a daisy in her dark hair. She wrinkled up her nose.
What are you doing?
Jumping up and down on the suitcase, Emma stood up and kicked off her shoes.
Submit,
she said to the suitcase and climbed on top of it.
Okay, I'm jumping.
Christina looked horrified.
Have you never heard of a packing cube?
What's a packing cube? Is it some sort of extra-dimensional space? She started to jump up and down on the suitcase as if it were a trampoline. Christina leaned back against the door.
It's good to see you so happy.
The suitcase made a horrible sound. Emma stopped jumping.
Quick, zip it!
Clucking, Christina got down on her knees and yanked the zipper closed. Emma jumped down to the floor and they both regarded the bulging suitcase, Christina with apprehension and Emma with pride.
What are you going to do the next time you have to close it? Christina said. I'm not thinking that far ahead.
Emma wondered if she should have dressed up a bit more. The party was meant to be casual, just a group of them celebrating Aline and Helen's official ascension to heads of the Los Angeles Institute. Or at least that was the story. She'd found a silk midi dress from the 60s with laces up and down the back, and thought it was playful and retro.
But Christina looked so elegant and calm that Emma wondered if she should have gone more formal. She determined to find her big gold hair clip somewhere and put her hair up. She just hoped it wasn't in her suitcase, because that was a definite no-go area.
Do I really seem happy?
Christina tucked a stray lock of hair behind Emma's ear.
More happy than I've ever seen you before, she said.
And because she was Christina, every word she spoke shone with sincerity.
I'm so, so glad for you.
Emma flopped back onto her bed. Something poked her in the back. It was her hair clip.
She seized it with relief.
But what about you, Tina? I worry you're not happy.
Christina shrugged her daisy shoulders.
I am all right. I'm surviving.
Christina, I love you. You're my best friend, Emma said. And it was easy to say now, best friend, because while Julian was still her best friend, too, he was more than that as well, and finally everyone knew it.
Surviving isn't enough. What about being happy?
Christina sighed and sat down next to Emma.
We will get there, Mark and I. We are happy. And yet we also know that there is a greater happiness we could have had. And we worry about Kieran every day.
Did you contact Dan? Emma asked.
I did, but he did not reply. Perhaps it is not something Kieran wants.
Emma frowned. She found the whole business confusing. But one thing she was certain of, there was nothing Kieran wanted more than to be with Mark and Christina.
Christina!
A voice echoed faintly from outside the institute. Emma scrambled across the bed to the window and threw it open. A second later, Christina was beside her. They both poked their heads outside to see Diego and Jaime standing on the front lawn, waving their arms energetically.
Christina, come down!
Christina started to laugh, and for a moment, under her quiet sadness, Emma saw the girl she must have been in Mexico City when she was a child, tearing around with the Rosales brothers and getting into trouble. She couldn't help but smile.
I wish I'd known you then, Tina. I hope we'll be friends our whole lives.
But Christina was smiling, and Emma didn't want to break her fragile good mood with wistfulness.
Come on, she said, grabbing a pair of sandals. Let's go down to the beach.
With help from Ragnar and Katerina, the sandy strip of coast below the institute had been blocked off for their private use. The area encircled by glamoured signs claiming the beach was closed due to a terrible sand crab infestation. Magnus had also thrown up muffling spells that quieted the sounds of traffic from the highway. Emma knew he hadn't been involved in the weather, but it was almost as if he had. A perfect day. The sky blue and deep, the waves like blue satin threaded with gold. Shadowhunters and downworlders dotted the beach, all up and down the curve of golden sand, encircled with rocks. Alec, tall and handsome, in an ivory sweater and black pants, was helping Katerina and Ragnar set up tables of food. Emma noticed that his hands shook slightly as he set out plates and chopsticks. Magnus had summoned dumplings from all over the world. Chinese jiaozi, Japanese gyoza, Polish cheese pierogi, buttery Russian pelmeni, Korean mandu. Ragnar had provided bottles of ludicrously expensive wine from his favorite Argentinian vintner, as well as French sparkling water and apple juice for the kids. Katerina had created a fountain of Swiss chocolate, which had already attracted the attention of Max and Rafe.
Sandy fingers out of the chocolate, Magnus was telling them, or I'll turn you both into sea sponges.
Christina headed off down the beach with the Rosales brothers to catch up with Mark, who had been sitting alone on a hillock of sand, his eyes fixed on the middle distance. Emma bent to lace her sandal. While she straightened up, Julian had appeared, his jeans rolled to his knees and his bare feet sandy from playing at the water's edge with Tavi and Helen. He looked carefree in a way she had almost never seen him. His blue-green eyes sparkled like the sea glass at his wrists, and his smile was